Okay, everyone. Welcome. This is our second Module 6 call, and we are continuing our exploration of the protectors, right? The four main protectors that our clients are likely to show up with. So what I wanted to go through with you today is just to revisit the aims of this module, like why this work is important. And then we're going to move into how to actually coach with these protectors. As you've probably given some thought to this, if you've been looking at the videos or even watched the call from last week or you're here for it, it's good to know this information. But coaching with someone, helping them to actually unhook from these patterns of protection, that's where the magic really happens. And so I'm hoping that today you're going to walk away with some really inspired ideas for how you can start to offer some interventions to your clients, maybe start to practice these yourself. I know for me this has been huge, and it's work that I just keep on doing. So we'll move into this. I'm glad, Kirsty, that's great. Exactly what you and Irene are pondering in your practice pod. Like, how do you do this? Yeah. And we'll talk a little bit about how you can take this away to play with it with your clients, with yourselves, and your practice pods. Yeah, sound good? Okay, so let's just revisit what we mean by the protector. So this is the way we're characterizing self-doubt. It is a part of us. I believe it's a part of every human, and it shows up very differently. But we'll kind of know we've got a protector that's sort of in the driver's seat because of the beliefs we're holding, how we're behaving as a result of those beliefs. And sometimes just this is a pattern that forms over time. So your clients will say, I can never do this. I'm this kind of person. And it's a great way to sort of look at, I think every time a client says, I'm this or I'm that, and it's a kind of self-doubty belief, it's an invitation to look at, you know, ask them, do you want to look at where that comes from and why, and what kind of pattern that's forming for you? The important thing to remember here is that the protector's job is to keep us safe from perceived risks, right? So the protector holds all of the stories, all of the body sensations, all of the emotions, the memories, and, you know, the projected worst case scenario futures, often worst case scenarios, that we have experienced. Right, so it's sort of, you know, this idea that the body keeps score. I think it's the protector that's keeping score, right? There's a part of us that is always braced for a risk, for a threat. It's a very human response to any kind of psychological risk. The thing to remember is that it's a perceived risk. It's based on past information. Right. So as we were talking about where our protective beliefs come from, where those root causes come from, often when we were much younger, less experienced, often in emotive states, we kind of made decisions. I've got to do this to keep myself safe. I've got to do this. I've got to be this person to belong here. And we haven't questioned those. Right. So we are acting on that past risk experience. When we hold ourselves back, our protectors feel safe. They sort of relax. So, oh, okay, cool. You're eating Doritos on the sofa. Nothing bad can happen, right? You won't take that risk by sending out that salesy email to your list, right, if you're building a business. And so our protectors then feel like, oh, cool, I've done my job. I've held you back from that risk. And of course, the unintended consequences, they also hold us back from life. Our protectors can't distinguish between a risk and something that we can manage. They don't let us take that chance, right? Is that making sense to everyone? Yeah? And so we end up with these patterns that are really common, that lots of people experience that helps us to see beyond the kind of idea that we all have a self-sabotaging inner critic, that actually there are different nuances that come out. And these are based on our stress response. And we talked about these last week, right? The critic, the martyr, the scapegoat, and the bystander. The thing I want you to really remember here as we start to talk about how to coach with this is you can't change the protector with the same energy that created it. Right? You cannot change the protective beliefs, behaviors, or patterns with the same energy that created it. If there's one thing, right, that I've learned from working with the protectors, those parts of us that want to keep ourselves safe, we can't use the same energy that created it. And what I mean by that is that we've got to get a bit more sophisticated, right, in terms of our interventions as coaches. So when it comes to working with the critic, we move round to self-acceptance, right? We start to use the resources of self-acceptance. You can't fight a critic with a critic. Won't work. You just end up in a war with each other. And this is particularly true if you also have a critic, right? It's like it's ripe for entanglement as coaches. So with the critic, we use the resources of self-acceptance. I'm going to talk about the real detail around this as we move through this module. With the martyr, we're moving to self-worth. With the scapegoat, to self-trust. And to the bystander, to self-belief. Right, so it's a pattern it's a model that helps you to remember. You're just moving around in a clockwise direction. When you spot a scapegoat, you can't out-quit a quitter, right? It's like that energy won't work. So we've got to use something different. And these are the resources that help us to move forward. They're deeply effective, right? So what does this actually look like in practice? I'm going to go through these in order. And we're going to talk about the experiments and the interventions. And please feel free to step in, chat. Let's have a conversation about this and how this might work. Think about your clients and the kinds of protectors that you see commonly. Think about your own protectors that dominate in different aspects of your life or in different contexts. So just a reminder, the critic is all about being perfect. Perfection shows up in different flavors. It could be, you know, I have to be the most put together one. I have to be the organizer, I have to be the smartest one, right? It depends on what that looks like. I have to work the hardest, basically, in whatever realm this shows up in. And it's driven by this core belief, I'm not good enough. And so the behavior that we see is overworking, and it's all about needing to prove yourself, right? The fears of the critic, what's underneath all of this is losing control and being criticized, feeling too much, right? So remember, this is one of the overfunctioning protectors. So we can't give someone with a critic protector more work to do because they're already overworking, right? All it does is feed the critic, and they end up using the very thing that we're trying to help them with, they end up using that as a sort of weapon. It's like more evidence. I've got to keep working harder, right? So we want to move to experimenting with compassion and imperfection, right? So this is all about moving that critic into self-acceptance, right? Can you accept that you can offer yourself some compassion? You don't have to work the hardest. Can you accept that you can be imperfect and still be loved? Make sense? So some ideas for this, and this is one that is fantastic for overworkers, invite your client to speak to themselves with compassion 100% of the time for 24 hours or 48 hours. when they find themselves inevitably doing it imperfectly, criticizing or judging or bullying, they apologize to themselves and start again and just notice what comes up. So for those of you who maybe have a critic protector, can you imagine putting your energy into speaking to yourself with 100% compassion 100% of the time? Yeah? What's coming up for you? I'm going to stop the share so we can check in on this. What? Tell me what is happening as you think about that.
I guess my first thought is, but I don't deserve no criticism for 24 hours. Like, it's, yeah, no. It would be really challenging, I think, to do that. Really challenging.
So what do you think?
I should try.
Well, right. I'm curious to know, Kirsty, what do you think speaking to yourself with that critical voice, what do you think that protects you from?
I think probably it's a failure thing for me. Like, if I keep doing all of the things because I have to, then I won't. That's the only way I won't fail.
As you say that out loud, is there a part of you that's going, interesting theory?
Yes, it is, because the thing that I could have said, if I don't do this, I won't succeed, but I didn't even put the word succeed into my sentence. It was like, it's the only way I won't fail. And that was like, oh, like, I'm not even thinking about success or a positive option here.
Yeah.
It's that fear of failure, 100%.
Yeah. So just notice that kind of logic that's currently playing out for you is the only way to avoid failure is to do everything right.
Yeah.
I can't lose, if I speak to myself with compassion, I'm just putting words in your mouth here, but what I'm hearing you say is, if I speak to myself with compassion, I might lose my edge.
Yeah.
Then that's
it's that almost like I that, feel like that's my, that's motivational, it's not the right word, but that's, yeah. I use a stick approach with myself, not a carrot approach. So yeah.
And so, of course, it makes sense, right? Because I imagine, well, knowing you, you have created a lot of success in your life using this approach. Why would you question it?
Yeah.
Right? And so it's interesting, isn't it, that it can feel a little edgy, to use the pun, to think about offering yourself some compassion.
Yep.
Because really you've associated that with the risk of failure. If you lose your
edge, I associate that with taking my foot off the gas and therefore failure.
Yeah.
It's like I have to go at 90 miles an hour all the time.
Yeah. And so this is the thing, right? If that feels really exciting to you and good to you and positive to you, like, because look, some of us, and I'm one of these people, come into this world going, okay, use me up, right? And we get off on being productive and all of that jazz, right? That feels really exciting and satisfying to us. And it can tip into this protective pattern when actually we're not moving towards something, we're moving away from something. Right, so we're not moving towards success and service and, you know, living by our values. We're actually trying to avoid failure. It's a totally different energy.
Yes.
Yeah. So this experiment might be fun to play with.
Mm.
If it feels like something to play with, right?
It couldn't have come at a better time. Just before this call, I was up on the roof trying not to cry because I've given myself so much to do. I'm completely overwhelmed. But if I don't do all of it, then somebody else will do it and I won't be good enough. And I literally had that thought process this morning. And now I'm getting tearful because I'm completely overwhelmed right now. So it probably would be a good exercise for me to take away and do. Sorry, got myself in a right pickle this week.
Yeah. Yeah, I just really want to offer how great it is just to admit to yourself, oh, I'm overwhelmed. Right? That's part of self-acceptance, is accepting how we are feeling, not how we want to be feeling. So it's like playing with your, you know, self-acceptance, and we'll come on to talking about this in later modules, but self-acceptance is all about our needs and emotions and kind of being in the flow of that. So it's very watery self-acceptance to me, whereas self-belief is the fire, right? That's the thing that's in this, the critic is the shadow of that. You know, when our fire tips into, oh, don't let it go out. So just offering yourself that compassion, oh, it's okay to be overwhelmed. It's okay to be overwhelmed. You've taken on a lot, so of course you feel a bit overwhelmed. You know, rather than you always get into this situation or any kind of other judgy sort of thoughts and beliefs that might pop up, right? So yeah, an invitation for you to play with that compassion, Kirstie, sitting in your needs and your emotions, looking at how you can bring in that healthy adult self to support you. Thank you for sharing. That's the perfect example to demonstrate this. So we're all grateful. Yeah. Anka.
I just have a little bit of a story for the opposite, because I was just with my husband on the weekend in an institute. They are looking for 8 years already for a managing director and a program director, and they can't find anybody. And before they found people, they exhausted them and they ran away. So they are still 8 years later trying to do the same thing. And it's exactly looking for somebody who is ready to jump into an overwhelming, impossible situation out of this kind of motivation of I have to kind of get through it. I have to tough it up. I have to be able to do it. And nobody takes it. And the people who come closer to maybe step in a little bit, they sniff it right away and they retreat into side jobs in this whole situation of a volunteering role where they can step out all the time. And so they wanted us to take those roles, and we were warned before. And my feeling was like we were warned before, and my husband and me had talked about it quite a bit, what we are ready to do and what not. And we were a team. We had two people, and we had said, if only as a team and only as team managers. And I myself, and also my husband himself, he felt like as long as we are personally on our own team, we are more flexible, we can take on more, and we can't really fail because we are like, I am on my own team. And that is exactly the compassion and like the clarity about the needs I have, the qualities I have, the flaws or the difficulties or the weaknesses I have, and also what I need in order to be ready to take on something that can be challenging. So basically being on my own team feels different than just self-acceptance. It feels strengthening to me, this idea. And we noticed this because we were two people already. We were already coming in as a team. And I thought it was quite an interesting situation, what we just said here, and what you just shared, Kirstie, that usually we think we have to be able to do it all alone. And everybody else is doing it also alone. And we are bad if we don't. And then we feel like, oh my God, now. And then the story is whatever the story is for everybody, why we can't do what the others can do. But very likely within the other person, it looks very similar. And it's kind of a situation that's so painful for everybody.
You know, Ankur, I think this is a fantastic example of the natural consequences of self-belief, right? When humans say, actually, no one can do this job in the way that you've done it. So we're out. And so you, like, your organization has waited 8 years to fill that role. It's like, when do they decide, or oh, we need to change this? Right. And it's interesting. I think at the moment we're seeing a lot of what's called quiet quitting, you know, where people are just saying, this is ridiculous how much we're expected to do. And every time we work over our contracted hours, we're working for free. Right. So capitalism is all about exploiting our labor, our skills and experience and knowledge. So every time we participate in that, we allow it. Every time we say, no, this isn't going to work for me. I'm not going to do this in this way. I am going to work my contracted hours or whatever, or a reasonable amount over that that feels good to me. But I'm not going to participate in this setup. We come back to self-acceptance. Oh, we're human beings with needs and emotions. And, you know, remember that critic martyr combo, right? I've got to be perfect and you're more important than me, are the underlying beliefs. So our organizational structure, particularly in profit-driven organizations, is ripe for our self-doubt. Absolutely loves it when we have imposter syndrome as women, because we work really freaking hard to prove ourselves. Has no interest in resolving that, otherwise it wouldn't have been a thing for the last 50 years, right? So it's like these wider systems that are outside our immediate experience, they're also contributing to all of this. That's where we're getting all this evidence. You know, when people get a bonus for, you know, going beyond, going the extra mile, it's like all you're doing is reinforcing the exploitation of humans. So this is, you know, for me, this feels quite mission-led, you know, this work, because as more and more of our clients start to, as we and our clients start to see, oh, no, we're humans with needs and emotions and lives outside of our work structure, and these are the boundaries that I'm prepared to put in place, and I trust that that will be met, or another organization will. And so, you know, when we have our own back, as you're describing, Ankit, we become really powerful. So while speaking to yourself with compassion for 24 hours can feel like, oh, that's a bit edgy, I have seen this so many times that it is a gateway drug into real meaningful shifts and changes of actual, like, how we see the world starts to shift and change. And having coached with a lot of, and I know a lot of you work with leaders, and your clients are in leadership roles. When we start to, because that kind of that archetype of the conductor is that prime leadership role. They are they conduct the orchestra of their lives. Then they will want to step into those leadership roles. They'll feel most comfortable there. And this critic protector can often evolve as they keep on proving themselves, right? Without the balance of the healthy adult self. So they'll often come to coaching going, I don't even know who I am anymore. Or I can't do this anymore and I don't know what else to do. Or I've reached a point in my life where I don't need to work this hard, but I don't know who I am without it, right? And so our job is to say, you're a whole human being with needs and emotions, and let's experiment. Let's find out who you are, right? So, yeah, the critic is a biggie. Critic is a biggie. Let me show you some other experiments that can help you play with compassion and imperfection. If your client is a parent, let their kids plan the whole weekend, right? Invite your client to learn an instrument or a craft, something that they can't be perfect at straight away. If they're the sort of person that's like, the house has to be spotless, leave the dishes in the sink overnight. If they have to be put together 100% of the time, just stop wearing makeup for a week. The idea behind these experiments is play with imperfection in a low risk way. Just notice that it's okay. It's okay. You know, there is a great analogy that I've seen where, you know, we often feel like we're juggling too many balls. And not all of the balls are made of the same stuff, right? Some are made of glass, i.e. the kids have to be fed, or, you know, that kind of thing. The dog has to be fed. But some of them can fall, right? Some of them are made of rubber. You know, I don't make that one meeting. They'll bounce. It'll be okay. So the trick is to use discernment, not try to do everything, but have a bit more discernment about what are the non-negotiables, and then what are the things that really need to be done? What do we need to start saying no to? Right? But that can often feel too much at the start. So just letting the kids plan a weekend, right, where they say, right, we're going swimming, and then we're going in the forest, and then we're, you know, having pizza for all three meals. It's like, amazing. You don't have to manage that, right? You can be, it's okay to not be the perfect parent. You can have some joy and fun with them. So the idea is behind these experiments, and, you know, this is where you get to really bring your own creativity into this. Like, what would it be like to not be imperfect? What I will often ask a client is, who in your life are you a bit jealous of because they are a bit imperfect, right? What do they do? What do you imagine they're doing? Can you, you know, build an experiment off that? Remember, these are really low risk things, right? Create an experiment around where the client is overworking and be really specific, right? So a lot of the experiments that I would use for clients who work kind of classic overworking in that leadership type role is to have them choose a time where they would turn off their phone at night, their work phone at night. Like, what feels reasonable? Because I've had clients who never turn their phone off, and they charge their phones right by their bed, and they have it so that a text message will come through at 4 a.m, you know, from someone else in their organization who's equally unable to kind of switch off, right? So, and, you know, having, I was part of the BlackBerry generation of executives where we had this little red light that would feel like an alarm going off every minute or so. And it would just constantly flash going, you're not doing enough. You're not doing enough. It's awful. So I completely relate to this, but just have your client say, okay, what feels doable? If they've never turned their phone off, you can say, okay, at 10 o'clock, can you turn your phone off? Or, you know, 11 o'clock, whenever they go to bed, can you turn your phone off? Right. And it's like getting them to experiment with that. Just try that for a week and then see how it feels. See how it how their sleep patterns improve, how they have a bit more energy, a bit more capacity. Bring it down further until they're clocking off at 6 o'clock or 5 o'clock and they're turning their phone off as they do that. And they don't have email on their phone. They don't, you know, like, they're actually putting some really healthy boundaries in place. And if they're in leadership positions, they start encouraging their teams to do the same thing. Okay. Because a healthy workforce is much happier and more productive and has more fun, right? Feels safer. So the thing to remember here is that your client cannot do enough for the critic to feel safe, right? We can't match the energy of what created it to change the protector, right? Can't do that. Can't change the protector by matching the energy. Safety, emotional, physical, psychological safety does not come from doing too much, from overworking. It comes from treating yourself with compassion and imperfection and knowing that if you don't do the thing, you're still okay. Yeah. Just want to check in how that's feeling for you. Or anyone want to share anything that's coming up?
I have a question.
Yeah, Cassie.
So I'm reflecting as you're talking about a client that I have, and she's moving into a leadership role. And I'm realizing that there's a heavy presence of a critic. And I think it is that wanting to be perfect, doing everything. She's got a lot of things. She's going to have to move up to Abu Dhabi with this role. She's doing some stuff in her personal life. So she's got a lot of things going on. And she came and saying, was like, I need to change. I need to, I've been told, because she's now resigned, and her immediate bosses or people she works with in her current role are like, oh, well, that's great that you've got this job, but you need to change. And I think that's, I'm reflecting now that that's firing up some form of inner critic to her, in the sense of, I need to try and go and do this. And so she's doing LinkedIn Learning and she's trying to learn lots of stuff. And it's kicked over a load of worries as well, I think. And I'm just wondering now, because she wants to go from being a doer to an overseer, which obviously from being, you know, a manager and part of the team, where she's very under-resourced at the moment, has to do everything, to a team that's got more resources where she is a leader. And the experiment that she was going to go away, or the action she wanted to go and do, was to test some of this learning on her current team. And I'm wondering whether that's still doing something. So is that a risky experiment from a critic point of view, if you know that there's probably is a critic protector there?
Well, it sound I wouldn't know too much about the actual context, but what I would be checking in with, if she was my client, is what is the outcome she's hoping to achieve?
Yeah. So she wants to go from being a doer to an overseer. So she wants to be able to let go, basically. So what she was going to go away and try with her existing team, where she's got two people that she like oversees at the moment, was that she wouldn't micromanage them while they were doing something. She would give them a deadline, set a check-in date, and then rather than being like, well, I wouldn't have done it that way, she would be more like, well, are you happy with the work? Do you feel you could confidently go and present that to the next person up the chain? That's what she was going to go and kind of, so I suppose, stepping back and...
Yeah, so that's like learning the art of delegation, really, isn't it?
Yeah.
Right? So I think for people who are overworking, delegation can be an amazing tool. As a coach, I'd be really interested in what comes up for her before, during, and after she delegates. So... You know, because if she does this for 30 days or 30 tasks, whatever, she's going to see a marked difference, probably, I would have thought, if she carries on with it, from how she feels at the start to how she feels at the end. So from the coaching perspective, we're not that interested in the goal itself, right? Like, do the tasks get done and delegate it? We're interested in what is our client's experience of that experiment.
Perfect.
Right? So I would be just checking in with her, like, you know, and you, if you've already had the call, it sounds like you've already had the call, it may be that you can say, hey, something I've been thinking about you, something I'd love you to check in with yourself around is, what are your thoughts and feelings before, during, and after you delegate? And just notice that. Like, just, we don't need to worry about what's coming up, but we're going to be looking at patterns, you know, and it's totally natural at the start, right, to feel like, this is shit and risky and I don't trust them and I just want to step in. And it's like, you know, just notice that. Notice what you want to do. Notice how you kind of pay attention to your own experience, because you're a person with emotions and needs, right? The need to step in is filling some need for you, you know, it's fulfilling something in you. So let's play with that. And then what it means is that in your sessions, you're not so worried so much about the content of her experience as the process she goes through. Right. So it really shifts the session from, let me tell you what's happened in the last 2 weeks, to actual coaching.
Yeah.
Does that make sense, Cassie?
Yeah, no, that's a great way of checking it back in and bringing it back to her situation and her experience, as you said.
Yeah.
And then I guess bringing in that compassionate part as well, then. Yeah. What were you saying to yourself?
Yeah. And it's highly likely that she might need some help with coming up with more compassionate ways to speak to herself, right? My go-to is always be with reality, right? So compassion is not coddling. It's about being with reality and making reality okay. So, oh, you feel really angry that the person didn't do it to the standard that you had. It's okay. You're allowed to feel angry. Anger is just an emotion. So can you be with your anger? Right. So that's the thing, right? It's accepting I have these feelings. What happens is we have the feelings and then we pile, if we've got a critic protector, then we pile judgment on top. You shouldn't be feeling that. So you get a double whammy. And it's another way of working hard, right? Work hard at not feeling what you are feeling.
That's why I was suddenly wondering if, like, now she said in the session, well, it sounds like you're really trying to prepare, like over prepare, and you're piling more on yourself as mentally and physically, and I was then worried that she was going to go away and do this experiment of trying out. I mean, it sounded like, well, actually, rather than trying to wait till I get to this new job, I could just try it. It's a safe place. I could try it out on the people I already have.
Yeah.
But then I was worried, then when we were just reflecting on that, I was worried, oh, have I given her more to do?
Right. Yeah. Well, I think, our clients do want things to do.
Yeah.
Right. So it sounds like this is a great way in to just experimenting with it. See, in the truest sense, right? An experiment is just doing something different to see what will happen.
Yeah.
So I can completely understand why she would want to do that in the current team that she feels safe in.
Yeah.
Thanks. Cool. All right, loves. Let's move to the next one. The martyr. Just a reminder that the martyr is all about being needed, right? So it's the flip side of that self-acceptance, right? Where we dismiss our own needs, we pay much more attention to other people. It's the classic people-pleasing approach, right? And the core belief is, I don't matter as much as you do, right? So you see a person who is overgiving, they don't have many boundaries, a lot of self-sacrifice, all of that jazz. It's all about managing the fear that they will be abandoned, they'll be disliked, or they'll create conflict if they have their own needs, their own emotions. Yeah. So this is the flip side of self-acceptance. And, we want to play with self-worth here, right? So ideas for experimenting with acknowledging emotions and prioritizing needs. Yeah. So we're moving around. You're allowed to have your own stuff. So some things to recommend. I've got four experiments here. Practice saying no when you don't want to do something. Practice honesty with others. So someone who's overgiving, saying no when you don't want to do something can feel like a massive step, right? So what you can do as a sort of early bird experiment is notice all the times you want to say no, but you don't. Right? Just notice that. And again, awareness is a big first step, right? So another one is to audit each time they dismiss their own emotions or sacrifice their needs for someone else, right? What's the risk they're protecting themselves from? It's a great record for people to keep in between sessions. Yeah. How are you doing this in a way that is minimizing your own stuff? Another one, which, really rooted in self-worth. Self-worth is all about boundaries, right? It's all about what's okay and not okay for you. So claim some regular time and space and notice what comes up. Limit the time you spend doing tasks you don't enjoy. So I've had and Lisa Mabley, a SBCA coach who works with me in self-belief school, she works with a lot of mothers. That's her kind of main client group. And we talk about this all the time, about what happens when someone says, I want to have half an hour in the morning where I do yoga. And they claim that half an hour, and then all hell breaks loose on day three, right? Because someone comes in saying, where are my shorts for PE? and it's like, notice what happens when you claim that time and space, right? You're going to have all these demands rush in, all these temptations to say, I don't matter as much as you. And what do you want to, how do you want to manage that, right? What happens when you say, oh, I want to have, you know, 10 minutes in the morning where I meditate or I do some journaling or I go for a walk. And that puts an additional burden on your partner or your family in some way. That means, oh, someone else has to walk the dog or, you know, feed the kids or whatever so that you can have that time and space, right? So you're inviting a conversation, a negotiation that doesn't have to involve abandonment or conflict or any of those things, but the risk will be there, right? So it's like experimenting with these things in low risk ways, you know? What does it mean when you limit the time you spend doing tasks you don't enjoy? How do you navigate all of that? Are there things at work that you, as a team, you, if you're in a team at work, how can you divvy up the tasks so that everyone doesn't have to do a task they don't like, right? Doesn't mean that everyone has to do only does things they love, but can everyone kind of let go of something they don't want to do, right? So you start to see, oh, I can negotiate this, right? I can negotiate my boundaries, can navigate the space I take up. And create an experiment around where the client is overgiving. Be really specific to their experience. Right. So what are they doing? Where is the tipping point for them? What can they do to play with that? The thing to remember, the client cannot give enough for the martyr to feel safe. Can't give enough. It's not where safety comes from. Safety comes from, no matter what my capacity is, I have emotions, I have needs, I am still acceptable, lovable, I belong to me, right? Just want to check in with you around that martyr protector, experimenting with that. Those of you who maybe have clients who fit into that kind of role, that dynamic, how's that feeling for you?
Not on a client perspective, but I would say I am a bit of a martyr.
Yeah.
And the situation I have right now is that my husband's broken, well, he hasn't broken his ankle, he had an operation on his ankle. So he's in a plaster cast. So I am running around this house like a blue-assed, what's it?
Yeah.
Wanting to say no, but not being able to say no.
Interesting.
And I can feel the resentment kind of bubbling under a little. So that's just, yeah, I think I need to notice, yeah, what am I thinking when I want to say no
yeah.
at the moment? Because I can't possibly say no, because obviously he's upstairs, he can't get himself a cup of coffee.
Yeah, and it's interesting, isn't it? I can't possibly say no. You can.
Yeah, true. Or I could say in 5 minutes, or I'm just doing something, or whatever.
Right?
Yeah.
Like, isn't it interesting how your healthy adult self will offer you way more creative options when you see, oh, I can say no.
Yeah.
I am choosing to do this.
Yeah.
It's
in a minute is not a no.
No,
it feels like
it's
a no.
But you can say to him, okay, between these hours today, let me run you through my day. Between these hours, I just want you to have really low expectations about me being able to respond. right?
Yeah.
So unless it's like a loo emergency.
He can get himself, thankfully, he can get himself to the loo now, but that's, okay. You know, but yeah.
Yeah. But it is interesting, isn't it, that it's that rumor, that all or nothing thinking. I can't possibly say no.
Yeah, because I feel like I would be being rude, or it would cause a, you know, well, okay, fine, if you don't want to help me. Like, yeah. You know, it would.
Whereas what is actually happening is I am choosing to resent my partner.
Yeah. And you can't help the fact that he's had to have an operation. So it made me think for Anchor, in terms of, yeah, like people that are in caring positions or anything like that, you know, where it's not always, but yeah, then that reframe of, well, actually I can do it, but in a moment, or I'm just doing something, or boundaries, or whatever it might be. That's interesting.
And in a work scenario, particularly in like a, you know, when you're part of a team, asking other people, can you help me out here? I'm drowning today. I'm going to need some help, right? That often, for that, if you have a martyr protector, feels like failure. I can't ask for help, because then they'll think I'm selfish, I'm not coping, somehow I'm blah, blah, blah. Insert story here, right? So, you know, practicing that is a really healthy way of, you know, healing in community. We do need each other, right? Yeah, Anke.
Yeah, exactly. From the nursing team, I have some like things I discovered which I thought were very interesting. Like, because many of us are martyrs, that's why we chose this job, because it's coming very natural to us to just like to help and we feel good about ourselves. And there are always, in every team, there are some people who try to get out of every, like sneak out of every possible loophole that shows up, and others who jump on it and then criticize and slander and all this kind of stuff. So, and feel like they feel like without me nothing will work, and these people who try to get out as much as they can, they are not really part of the team, like they are, you know, all this kind of human dynamic is happening. And one thing I think is showing up also in every team is that we all have our natural gifts. And we all have our natural difficulties. And if we trust that our own gifts are what's needed, and also see that, like, for example, for me, it's very easy to do 5 jobs for somebody else. But for somebody else who has 5 kids and is also like has an autoimmune disease and headache, it's maybe not so easy. So I can easily take it on, and I don't have to feel bad about it, and compare on the level of amount, because amount is difficult to compare. Because I never know what somebody else has on their shoulders, you know, like you with your husband right now, Cassie, like at the moment you have more on your shoulders. It's just natural. And at some point that time will be over. But other people might feel like, well, why is she now not doing this kind of stuff anymore? So I can't judge why somebody is not jumping on a task like in nursing. There are many things we have as a team. We have to organize medication and bandage materials and whatever. So, and even sometimes food when somebody is in the hospital. So to make sure that the patients have what they need and the other colleagues have what they need. And this like to not judge the other saves me energy. To do what I can is something I can give. And to also be very clear where I don't have the capacity or the quality to do it gives me the freedom to also step out when it's the appropriate time or situation.
Just a note on that, like the idea that there are some people that, so, okay, there's 2 things I want to share. One is, these protectors are not describing personalities. They're describing our protective patterns, right? So I just noticed you said we're all martyrs, or it's right. So I just want, you know what I mean? Right. I just wanted to kind of clarify that just in case. And the second thing is, you know, I see that behavior spectrum of the people who overgive and who don't do anything, right? Who want to get out of it. That is all on that spectrum. And you're right, we'll never know what's going on underneath all of that, but the way to intervene is the same: boundaries, right? What is okay and what is not okay, managing those expectations of the team. And I've worked with a lot of clients who are, have that, you know, I mean, this is team dynamics, right? The same thing. And it's always about creating that safety so that people can say, on a daily basis, I'm going to need some help today because, I have capacity today. So that people get a sense of each other's, you know, needs and emotions. And I don't know how many teams I've, you know, worked with over the years where there is no communication among the team at the start and the end of the day or the end of the day, right? There's just not, it's like we just come in, we get a coffee, we dive into our computers, or we go off and work with whoever. And there is no conversation. So no one really knows what everyone's doing, which means we make a ton of assumptions. And if we have our protectors in charge, we're going to make a ton of assumptions rooted in those belief, in those protective beliefs. Right? So, you know, I'm so a fan of, especially if you're working in corporate environments or with teams, I think the most effective thing we can do is air this out and have regular communication where everybody knows what's going on with each other, where we allow ourselves to feel some safety among the team. You spend an awful lot of time at work. And I have seen, you know, teams that do this where there is that safety to just check in with each other, and that is that becomes a kind of ritual each morning. It can radically change the dynamic of the team. It very much, you know, turns this on its head, because the protector doesn't need to guess and manage risks because we've had the information. Yeah. So it's so fascinating when we start to see these protectors show up in a team dynamic. Absolutely. Yeah. And in a marriage, Cassie. Yeah. Good fun. Good fun. Okay, let's talk about the scapegoat. Remember, the scapegoat is very much the shadow of self-worth. So the protective aim here is, look, just don't try. That's where safety is. And it's the belief here is, it's so much harder for me. So your scapegoat is going to feel overwhelmed. And this isn't about, notice the there is a partnership here with the critic, right? The critic is overworking. The scapegoat is overwhelmed. Someone who is overworking can feel overwhelmed, but that is not their protective. That is not their protective pattern. Get the difference? Yeah. So the scapegoat is overwhelmed with life, like with basic life stuff. Adulting is too hard, basically. And it's all about fearing responsibility, consistency, keeping promises. Whereas the critic will be overly responsible, right? Often far too consistently overworking and, you know, doing, you know, promising everyone everything, right? So I just want you to notice that difference there. So when we're working with the scapegoat, when we're coaching and experimenting with this, we move around to self-trust, right? So this is all about keeping promises and taking responsibility. So the scapegoat experiments, making a decision about a change that the client wants to make. So an example here, I'm always late, right? That can change to, I'm always 5 minutes early, right? And then they try and organize their lives around being 5 minutes early all the time. What needs to happen for them to be able to do that? How do you organize your life to do that? Because at the moment, there's a pattern. I'm always late. That's just who I am. I'm late to stuff. I'm disorganized and I'm late. I've got too much on and I'm late. But what if you change that belief to, I'm always 5 minutes early, and what do you need to do? Who do you need to be able to do that? Like, you know, and I've put some examples in here about putting your clocks back 5 minutes, organizing your calendar, that kind of thing, so that you start to see, am I always late or am I just believing that that's who I am? Can I trust myself to show up for myself and change that story? So that's just an example, right? But it could be like, I never pay my bills on time, right? I'm always running out of money at the end of the month because I'm not really, you know, I don't really pay attention to my budgets. Yeah. So it's about kind of playing with, well, how is that true or is that a belief you have? Yeah. Resistance is usually really entrenched for the scapegoat because an experiment is going to feel too hard, right? Because it's so much harder for the scapegoat, right? Any kind of complexity is going to feel hard. So encouraging really small doable steps, spending a session or part of a session planning what those steps are going to be so that the client is like, oh yeah, I can do that. Like that, I don't have resistance to that. That is the way forward. And also anticipating setbacks, right? So if you are going to be late, what can you do? Rather than just show up late, what can you do? What choices do you have? What could go wrong? Like, how do you anticipate life happening? Right. So rather than feeling like it just stuff just happens to you, how can you happen to it? How can you take care of yourself and trust yourself to show up? Yeah. With a scapegoat, that protective pattern is all about quitting, right? It's safer to quit, but that is never going to feel satisfying. Never feel safe. It just feels like, oh, I've just, it's another thing I've done. Right. I found as well that the scapegoat will often partner with other protective patterns. So I'll find that people who are have a lot of like work responsibility and are kind of overworking in that work arena, when it comes to their home life, will be like, it's just chaotic. So there can be quite a lot of shame around the scapegoat pattern. And it's almost like, oh, I should really have my shit together about this, is usually what people will say, some version of that. And so we can start to say, okay, well, paying your bills on time, great. You know, let's do that. That will take off so much pressure and stress. So how do we set that up, right? So you make a plan with the client. It's okay, right? It's okay. It's okay to make a plan in a session for something that maybe feels a bit like life admin. Often a client will say, "No, it's fine. I know what to do." But that is part of the scapegoat. Is like, oh, I don't really know what to do, but I don't know how to ask for help, and I'm so overwhelmed by this. So anything we can do to help them to figure out some of this stuff can really help. Anyone feel like, yeah, I have scapegoat clients with a scapegoat pattern? No one. Yeah.
Could somebody with procrastination tendencies be scapegoating?
Usually scapegoaty or bystander.
Okay.
Yeah. Yep. Absolutely.
Because I have a peer client who's always, I want to be more consistent with myself. I do these tasks, but it's not consistent enough.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's like, so what needs to change for you to do that? How do we put a plan in place for you to do that? And, you know, the thing about working with these experiments is it is different to how they've been doing things. So it's very natural to feel some resistance and feel some, you know, sort of worry, fear, upset, a feeling of like, oh, I can't really trust myself to do all of this. All of that can come up. And it's all about bringing in your healthy adult selves to support you. So yeah, procrastination, that kind of sense of sitting on the sidelines, not really, you know, not really participating. Comparison is often a big sign of a scapegoat. Like, I'm comparing myself to other people, but it's so much harder for me. Yeah. And it's like, okay, what is it that you want, you're comparing yourself to? What is it that you want to be doing that you're not? And then how do we put a plan in place for you to experiment with that, to play with it? The thing I think about these experiments as well is that we are holding ourselves back, remember, from perceived risks, not from actual risks that are true, but from the things that we worry about will happen. We don't know that those things are true until we've experimented and got some up-to-date feedback from the world. Yeah. But the scapegoat is always going to want to quit. There's always going to go, oh, it's too hard, it's too overwhelming. So if you see a client who is not doing that, like who is doing that, and they may do it in between sessions, right, where they quit, they say they're going to do something and then they don't do it. It's like, okay, well, that was too big a step. There's some resistance here. So let's look at how we can experiment with different things. Yeah. That, and, you know, the thing about this is that clients will often want to take the biggest challenge that they have and experiment with that. And I'm always about, let's experiment with the thing that's driving this behavior, rather than the biggest challenge you have. Yeah. Okay, the bystander, remember, is all about waiting. Sit on the sidelines and wait. So it's all about, I don't have enough information yet. I don't know enough yet to take action. So they're stuck in overthinking in some way, either researching, watching from the sidelines, unable to take action. And it's all about, they don't want to make the wrong choice, don't want to fail, don't want to look foolish. So with the bystander, we want to make decisions and take action. And what that should say is take action from values, right? So this is how we work with the bystander, is we connect it to self-belief. Yeah. What are your values? What are the things that really matter to you? What's the big vision of your life? The kind of fire in your belly, right? And how can you make decisions based on that, right? So if someone is stuck in research, it's because they've lost the connection with the kind of why they're doing it in the first place. So we move around to self-belief and we help connect them to, why does this matter anyway? Why would you bother? Right? So if you're working with a business owner who can't take action because they're waiting to feel like they should know more about social media. Like, why is social media even important? Oh, it's connected to my bigger mission in the world. This is, you know, it helps me connect to who I want to help. Okay, what do they need from you? What can you experiment with? Make some decisions. Take some actions from your values. You know? So it helps kind of alleviate that sense of it's all about you and you've got to know everything. So some great ways to start moving that bystander pattern is to invite the client to commit to a doable action on the spot in the session. So I've had clients make phone calls, send emails, post on social media in the session because they've been waiting to take action. Right. It's like, well, can you do it right now? Yeah. Okay. So let's do it. Let's see what that, you know, what are your fears before you do it? Then you do it in the session. And then afterwards, how does it feel? You can, for some clients, this is like, okay, cool. I will just do it. I'm waiting to push go and it's ready to go. So I'm going to do it. And inviting that bystander protector to have a say, what is it worried about? Yeah. Again, anticipating some setbacks, right? So usually the client will say, I'm confused. I don't know what I want. I don't know what I want to do. So we work with the client so that they start to trust themselves before they get confused, right? What could go wrong? What choices do you have? Where do your values play a part in that, those choices? Right? How can you speak to yourself in an encouraging way, right? That's what self-belief is all about. Encouragement, vision, values. And some great experiments for bystander, that bystander pattern, people with that bystander pattern, is letting them look foolish in safe ways. Because that's often a really big concern, a real risk. So any kind of creative fun, dancing, play, creative pursuits, anything where the client is able to be in the moment, be embodied in the moment, can really help. Right? Look foolish and feel safe, even as you're looking foolish, right? Or as you're not doing it in the right way, in the perfect way. Right? When you don't know enough, you start to play with that and you start to see, oh, I can take action. I can make decisions even when I don't have all the information and I'm okay. I can do it. I can even look foolish and I'm okay. Right. So the client can't wait long enough for the bystander to feel safe. That's not, waiting is not where safety comes from. So anything you can do to connect your client to their values, to their vision, to taking action without having every duck in a row is really going to help. If you are working with folks who have that bystander critic combo, this is about both connecting to vision and to emotions and needs, right? In the same way, if you've got people with that critic scapegoat combo, that's my combo, it's great. It's about doing enough, but also knowing when you need to ask for help and kind of experimenting with that, right? Can you trust yourself here? Trust yourself to be okay, whatever happens, however you feel. So you start to get to know these interventions, these ways of coaching with folks. It's all about helping them to see what else could be true. What can your healthy adult self offer you? How can that take care of your protective part that is worried? And as a coach, I think it gives you so much scope to be creative, really play with where the client's at. As we move into module 9 particularly, we look at like how to draw out some of these healthy adult self resources, and I've got some tools for you to play with. But it's building on these ideas of what is self-acceptance. That's all about emotions and needs. Self-worth is all about boundaries and advocacy for yourself, self-trust, you know, checking in on your intellect, your intuition, like taking perspectives, making choices. And self-belief is all about that vision and values, right? How can you encourage yourself to create the vision of your life from your values. So all of these aspects are, you know, fantastic resources when it comes to our protectors. We can't change the protector from the energy it was created in. We've got to move it out of that energy into something else. And the thing that I found is that our clients are smart, and they often, it's like a couple of experiments where they start to see what's possible. The reason we want to do that is because when you have new evidence of who you can be, you start to shift those protective beliefs. They no longer feel, you know, really solid. They no longer feel like they have such a grip on you because you've already got very recent evidence that it's not true 100% of the time. Right? So it allows you to kind of doubt your doubt, if you like. So I just want to check in, like, how is that feeling for you as sort of like ways to intervene? What, you know, what you can start to play with, bringing in those different parts? What's coming up? Maybe nothing. Yeah, Anka.
I tried, like Jane coached me on the four faces of the protector, and I used the story I told in the beginning with this kind of institute, we were looking into what actually is the protector there, and we came to the bystander, because basically I am not ready to jump in for good reasons, but I'm also, and I nearly felt like the bystander was a safe place for me to be. So, and then we had this kind of thing, like, well, interesting, can those what are they called, like those protectors in each of those four archetypes also be kind of a role, also we can step into? Do you have any experience like that?
So what I would offer is, our protectors are always trying to create some safety for us, but it's safety about perceived risk.
Mm-hmm.
So I would say that actually self-belief is playing a huge part in your decision, because your values don't align with that, the way you've described that role, right? So it doesn't sound to me like it's self-doubt that's holding you back. It's your values.
Thank you.
Right, which is a great thing, because what can happen, right, is we when we particularly, and you get a bit entrenched in this work, and I found this is, oh, hang on a freaking minute, I'm holding myself back because it's a no from me, right? So, you know, and this is why I think consent with our clients is super important. It's like, you get to keep that belief, you get to, we're not interested in change for change's sake, right? It's all about, where are you holding yourself back that does not feel good to you? And then what would you like to try, you know, to shift that? What might help you? And as a self-belief coach, how can I support you to make the change you want to make? Do we need to look at, you know, the beliefs that are underneath this, or do we need to look at the protective patterns here? How can you experiment and try something new in your life, just to see what might happen? So it's always about, you know, playing into, do you like the choice you're making? Oh, I love that. Your husband has a charger, Cassie, and you might run out of power. We're almost out anyway. So what I would encourage you to play with in your practice pods is to look at, you know, what kind of protector are you dealing with in a particular instance, And what does the healthy adult self offer you? Right? What is your healthy adult self saying to you about this pattern? And what is the experiment you want to try? What comes up when you think about doing that? What are the risks? And the thing about experiments is that they are going to feel a little bit risky, but they shouldn't, and there should be a little bit of resistance, like a little bit of, oh, I don't know what's going to happen. But it shouldn't feel like you have so much resistance that you can't take action, right? But the whole point of experimenting is so that you create true psychological safety for yourself, which the way I phrase that is, whatever happens, I've got me. Whatever happens, I've got me. Whatever happens in terms of an outcome that's unexpected, how I feel, what another person's reaction is, all of that. It's like, whatever happens, I've got me. That's where true safety is. When you're willing to kind of live in that place, then, you know, self-doubt really doesn't have that much to do because there's not a lot of risk. Right? Risk is always about anticipating an outcome that you don't want. But when you can actually be with all of those outcomes, like, oh, I might be disappointed, or oh, I might create some conflict. If you can be with that, then self-doubt massively plummets in terms of the role it has. Your protector hasn't got much to do. So in terms of playing with this, just getting into that mode of spotting the protective pattern that's at play, seeing what your healthy self has to offer you, or, you know, if you're coaching, what is your coach healthy self, what does your client's healthy self have to offer, and what's an experiment you could play with, you could offer to the client, what's that about? So you're getting the voice of the protector, right? They're going to give you the context and all the reasons why, and then you're getting the voice of the healthy self, and then you're starting to go, okay, what needs to shift? What's a way of intervening here? And that's where the experiment comes up. As low risk as possible. For those of you who kind of are starting to get to know and feel pretty au fait with your own protectors, any experiment you want to play with on your own, and Kirsty, you gave us such a beautiful example at the beginning of our call, you know, anything you can do just to play with this, you know, speaking to yourself with compassion, amazing, will radically shift your relationship with yourself. Whatever happens, I'm going to be kind to me. Sometimes our compassion can sound like, you can do this, it's okay. It's going to be shit for the next 3 days and then it will be fine, right? I've got this, right? It's not coddling. It's not coddling. It's not saying, you know, you can't do this or you're not capable. Yeah. It's very much about, what do you need to encourage yourself? Looks like we lost Cassie. Okay. I'm going to let you go play with experiments. I hope this has been fun just to sort of, you know, pull this apart a little bit more. Yeah.
Just a quick question about the call script, right? The recording. Is it going to be talked through within Scott group or?
Yes. So okay. Scott is going to also pick up on this more, and, you know, feel free to bring in any specific client stuff, any experiments you're testing out, and Scott can chat you through with that as well. Yeah.
Okay.
Great.
Okay, thank you.
Have fun, everyone. Take care. I'll see you next week.
Bye.
Bye.